We are going to bookend the program today with jobs, how many we don't have to start off, and what jobs mean at the end of the program. In between, small businesses, workers, and industries all trying to cope. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 2nd of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is one of those economic crises that at almost every turn turns out to be more serious than people had been guessing. Exhibit A, this morning's new report on new claims for unemployment insurance, an almost unimaginable 6.6 million people, double the already staggering 3.3 million from a week ago. Tomorrow, we get a look back at the whole month of March, which, bad as that report might be, and it is going to be bad, won't be the whole picture, because it's based on surveys that were done before things really went south. One thing we can confidently predict, though, wage gains last month probably weren't much to write home about. They had been meh for the better part of a decade now. And now that a recession is upon us, that really matters, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Since early 2019, wage gains have slowed down despite historically low unemployment. In fact, the average worker's wages have barely stayed ahead of inflation. NYU economist Edward Wolf is an authority on household wealth in America.
The wealth of middle class is still down by about 15-20%. So here we are at the cusp of another recession, and the middle class still hasn't recovered from the financial crisis.
That's a familiar story for Leanna Wright of Alexandria, Virginia. She's 46, and until last August, she worked as an office manager at a nonprofit. She made a little over $60,000 a year, and with the high cost of living in Northern Virginia, she struggled to make ends meet.
I never really had a lot of savings in the first place.
Then she got laid off. She's been temping, job hunting, and living off unemployment benefits. In early March, she landed a three-month gig as an executive assistant, which she can do from home. She's making $20 an hour and trying to catch back up financially.
It was difficult trying to prioritize what to pay and things like that. You know, I was really racking up the credit card debt.
Wright's finances going into this economic crisis are typical of middle-class Americans. NYU's Edward Wolf says back in 2007, the median household could lose its income but keep up its spending for 1.5 months. By 2016, that had fallen a lot.
The average family, in terms of income, really hasn't much financial reserves to maintain its normal consumption for more than a couple of weeks.
Further down the income scale, the story's worse. Higher up, it's better. Terry Williams is 54 and works for a roofing company near Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Her husband's a maintenance manager.
Every year he's getting an increase, I'm getting an increase.
Both of them are still working. So what if their jobs and income go away?
We'll be okay. I would say probably maybe 3 months. I really wouldn't want to push it more than that. But at that point, I'd have to reassess and then you start, you know, what bills don't I pay?
NYU's Edward Wolf says the top 20% of households have more than 2 years of money socked away to keep up their spending. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Staying with a theme here, wages, broadly speaking. While unemployment rises, some who are keeping their jobs are getting paid less. It started with top executives at Disney and Columbia Sportswear, Lyft and Marriott cutting their pay, sometimes to zero. Now that's trickling down at companies like SoulCycle and the medical device maker Boston Scientific. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
This week, L.A. copywriter Laura Cohn got a call from her employer with some good news, bad news. She could stay on, but with fewer hours and about a 30% pay cut.
To at least be working a little bit and to have, you know, a small amount of income coming in is better than nothing.
Nothing is what her husband is getting after losing his job as an office manager, so Cohn was glad her employer stopped at cutting her pay in hours.
They opted to keep people employed. So, you know, hey, we're all in this together.
UCLA management professor David Lewin hopes more firms will take this approach first before cutting jobs.
You can get to exactly the same labor cost reduction objective
And the upside is workers keep their benefits while businesses have an easier time recovering when they avoid layoffs. The downside, says Paul Davis at Cornell, pay cuts can be worse for morale and productivity. However, this time might be different.
I think that workers are going to be a little more understanding and a little more amenable, right, at least initially.
But he says as pay cuts spread further down the ladder from the executive suite, they have a broader impact on the economy. Part of that is just the number of people affected, and part of it is how hard pay cuts hit average working people. Copywriter Laura Cohn doesn't have to worry about a roof over her head. She's staying rent-free with family. But she has other bills coming due now that she's lost a chunk of her paycheck.
That was basically our health insurance premium,
which she definitely doesn't want to skip in the middle of a pandemic. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street ended to the upside today, even with that unemployment claims number. Yeah, I don't know. Details, numbers, you know the drill. In the category of workers still headed out into the economy to work every day, as opposed to down to the basement or into a spare room, those designated essential, of course, is Gail Harrell. She's a part-time employee at a convenience store called Royal Farms in Ashburn, Virginia. She's also one of the 10 people we are profiling in our series about the American labor force called The United States of Work. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Kai.
Let me ask you, first of all, how you're doing in these very strange times?
I'm doing fine. It's not a lot I can do. Just take one day at a time.
Yeah. You're still working, right?
I'm still working. Yes. Yeah, so that, I guess, helps to get out a little bit. But I don't, you know, I just work 2 to 3 days a week.
Yeah, I know. How are things at Royal Farms?
Slow. Not very busy, but people are buying a lot of gas. And probably, you know, chicken during lunch, dinner. We sell the chicken and the coffee in the morning.
Yeah. Last time we talked, you told me about the chicken and I should come by and get some. And I guess I will when I can travel again.
You're going to have to get some when we can travel.
I know. All these people who are buying gas, I wonder where they're going.
You know, I said the same thing. Do they think we're going to run out of gas?
Yeah.
And but, you know, some people still have to go to work because we have a lot of construction workers, landscapers that come through. So some people are working.
Mm-hmm. You're in the essential worker category in convenience stores,
yes.
But I do have to ask you, you are also in, and I'm going to do this without giving your age away too much, but you're in the high risk category. How do you feel getting out in public every day?
I can't worry about everything. I can't stop living, but I mean, I feel fine. I'm not scared. I work with my gloves on, wash my hands, wear gloves, take the gloves off, wash my hands after, depending on what I'm doing.
All right, good. Last time we spoke, one of the things that really lit you up when we were chatting was how much you love to travel. And in fact, that's why you work, to have money to do things you love to do, one of which is travel. You can't do that now.
Nope.
That must be tough for you.
You know, I probably need to be home. I've been cleaning out stuff, you know, stuff you've been putting off. That's what I've been doing. But I, you're right. Everything has stopped except work. No Red Hat, no AARP.
So Red Hat is the social group the ladies you travel with and you spend time with.
Exactly.
You can't do that now. And you are a really social person. That's, I keep coming back to that with you. That's your thing.
Yeah. Well, I get to see people when I go to the store. I still talk to them. We still Facebook.
Yeah. So what happens, though, Gail, if this lasts another, I don't know, 2 months? And,
I know.
Right? What are you going to do?
I guess my grandbaby and I are going to walk the dogs every day. Walk, work. I mean, you know, because I work, like I said, 2 to 3 days a week. But what's unique when we go to work now, if we get stopped by the police, we have a letter that we show them that we're essential.
Well, Gail, listen, take care of yourself, wash your hands, be super careful out there because we don't want anything to happen to you, okay?
I appreciate it.
One quick thing to mention here about Gail and the other 9 people we are following. The premise of this series was to find 10 actual people who could stand in for the 164 million of us in the American labor force. And we started with this question. These are the people who make the economy work, but is this economy working for them? Needless to say, when we started back in February and told you we were going to follow this group for a year, this is not the way we thought the year was going to go. And it's not the way they thought it was going to go either. Of these 10 people who we matched up against data from the Department of Labor, so they are roughly representative of the workforce as a whole, two of them have lost their jobs in the past month. In other words, in our admittedly unscientific sample, the unemployment rate is already 20%. Tomorrow's a big day for small businesses in this economy. They run pretty lean most of the time, those businesses. Only enough cash on hand to get them through maybe a couple of weeks of rough times, which, in a lot of places, those couple of weeks are already up. So, tomorrow is opening day for those businesses to be able to apply for loans coming out of that government rescue package. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Disaster loans have always been around, in some form or another. But this is different.
It's actually a phenomenal product and program.
Michael Roth is managing partner at the advisory firm Next Street, and he says the best part of these new loans is that they can be forgiven entirely.
If you take out $1 million loan, if your payroll costs plus your mortgage or rent payments and utility payments equals $1 million, you don't have to pay anything back.
Not one penny. Though, to get the loan forgiven, you have to use at least 75% of it to pay your employees. The federal government wants to get this money out quickly, all $350 billion of it. But lenders aren't sure how that's going to work. Daniel Marsh is president and CEO of the National Development Council, which lends to small businesses in underserved communities.
It's launching tomorrow, and we still have many questions open that we're awaiting SBA guidance that would allow lenders to really start lending with any volume.
He's worried about that, holding up help that business owners desperately need now, particularly in low-income neighborhoods. Cynthia Ward-Wickstrom of Main Street Alliance is worried about that too.
The banks are saying that the people they will be able to approve quickly are the ones that they have existing loan relationships with. So that exacerbates the inequity that already exists in the system.
But for all the issues and logistical challenges, this is the biggest source of support out there for small business owners. And if that's you, Michael Roth says his best advice is get ready to jump on this now, tomorrow.
I can't stress enough how important it is if you have the resources to be the first one in the door and to bang on the door of your banker, you should be doing it.
For people who don't have those resources, it may be a long time before they're able to get the help they need, if there's even any money left. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they're moving to digital events. They're also trying to innovate.
Now more than ever, right? You got to innovate. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 469 today, 2.2%, 21,413. The NASDAQ picked up 126 points, 1.7%, 7487. The S&P 500 added 56 points, 2.2%, 25.26. Oil and gas stocks surged after President Trump said he had spoken to leaders of oil exporting countries about production cuts. Remember, we've been telling you about the glut in supply that's out there, also falling demand. Hello. ExxonMobil jumped 7.6% today. Chevron surged 10.9%. ConocoPhillips packed on 14%. General Electric says it's planning to lay off thousands of workers who make airplane engines because nobody's flying, right? Shares down 1.9% there. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, y'all. It's Rima Khreis, host of Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable. And I'm here to tell you that we are back with a new season. Each week, we take a look at how money influences everything from our romantic relationships and friendships to our identities and the jobs we go after. New episodes every Thursday.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The more we learn about the nuts and bolts of how the rescue money from that $2 trillion package that Congress and the White House passed last week is supposed to get out into the economy, the more the haste is showing. As just one example, the rules for who exactly is eligible for those direct payments, $1,200 to individuals, that the law provides for. Those rules are going to miss a bunch of people. Any immigrant with a Social Security number, provided they fall below the $75,000 annual income threshold, gets a check. The problem is, that doesn't represent a whole lot of working immigrants in this country. And as Marketplace's Andy Eula reports, thousands of them have lost their jobs.
Up until about a month ago, Rosana Araujo made between $1,500 and $2,000 a month cleaning houses in Miami. But now?
They canceled all my jobs, and now I don't have money to pay the rent, and I don't have money to pay the electricity bill.
Araujo says she pays taxes on all of her earnings, but she doesn't have a Social Security number, which means even if she's paying into the system, she's not eligible for any public benefits, no COVID-19 check from the government. On top of that, she's worried about getting sick.
I'm really scared because if I get sick, I don't have health insurance.
The Trump administration has told immigrants that their status would not prohibit them from accessing any COVID-19 related health care. But Sandra Feist, an immigration attorney in Minneapolis, says many of her clients aren't buying it. Another uncertainty, many immigrants say they're getting a lot of mixed messages about the pandemic from their employers, particularly in agriculture. Stay-at-home orders in California have exempted farm workers.
Homeland Security says that you are an essential worker, and yet we're not making sure that they're staying safe.
And it's not just undocumented people who could be left out. Doug Rand is a former White House official who worked on immigration policy in the Obama administration.
You know, you're a U.S. citizen with a Social Security number, but on your tax return, you've got a spouse or a kid, and they're undocumented. Then nobody in that household is going to get a check.
I assume that the logic is that the federal government didn't want payments to be going to unauthorized immigrants in the United States.
That's Julia Gillad at the Migration Policy Institute, an immigration think tank. She says this administration is nothing if not consistent with its immigration policy. President Trump has maintained for years that illegal immigrants are a strain on the social safety net. Undocumented folks paid more than $27 billion in federal, state, and local taxes in 2017, according to the New American Economy, an immigration policy group. Legal immigrants contributed even more, almost $380 billion. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
If ever there was a time for all of us to understand the economic fundamentals, oh boy, this is it. So, good thing the Marketplace Morning Report is here for you. David and the gang on the early shift have a project going. It's called Econ Extra Credit. The basics, but not in a, you know, like painful way. There's a newsletter too, Econ Extra Credit newsletter. Marketplace.org/newsletters is where you can go to subscribe. There are parts of this economy, big parts of this economy, actually, that are being shut down because they have to. There are, though, some parts that aren't being shut down because basically they don't have to, but also because fundamentally they've got schedules. We are talking book publishing in particular right now, and even though some people might have extra reading time on their hands, it can be tricky to get a hold of actual physical books between closed retailers and Amazon delays, right? So we got Rachel Deal on the phone. She is the news director at Publishers Weekly. We got her on the phone to talk publishing in this coronavirus economy. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So is there a calendar question to be asked here? And look, I will fess up at the beginning that this is a naive question, but couldn't publishing just put its calendar on hold for 2.5 months? And then when finally we can all come out of quarantine, that's when you guys get back into action, you know?
Right. I mean, it's a nice thought. The reality of the situation is that...
It's a nice thought, she says very gently. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no. It is. And I think, you know, for books that are publishing now, if your publisher pushes that book to the fall, you know, the fall is historically when the publishers release their biggest titles. That means you're going to be competing for attention and airtime with some of the biggest books that are going to publish all year. So as bad as it is right now, I mean, will that be better for you?
Right. we should remember here, too, that there's an entire ecosystem built around the pub date, right? You've got author book tours and you've got literary conferences.
Exactly.
And yeah, so there's that whole thing as well.
Yeah. And I mean, look, it sucks right now. I mean, there's no easy way of putting it. You know, all in-person events are canceled, tours are canceled, you know, everything sort of, they're moving to digital events. They're also trying to innovate. And so, you know, let's say you have a novel coming out, you might be able to do an op-ed about what it's like to publish a novel during the, you know, the coronavirus, mm-hmm. even if it's mm-hmm. nothing to do with a pandemic or, you know, anything that's kind of right. sucking up all the airtime right now.
So big picture then, right? Publishers have their problems. Authors certainly have their problems. What's the worry, or what are you hearing from independent and smaller and maybe even larger booksellers about the lasting effect of this thing? Because you could see Amazon gobbling up whatever market share it hasn't gobbled up yet, and independent booksellers and maybe bigger ones too, just fundamentally going out of business in 2 to 3 months if this lasts.
Right. I mean, that is the existential threat. I mean, look, if a lot of independent booksellers go out of business, which, you know, it's, again, I mean, we'll see what this stimulus package can provide. And then the big, big concern is how, if Barnes & Noble can weather this storm, because they're the biggest stopgap against Amazon. And then I think people always think of publishing in terms of the, you know, the big corporate publishers, the, you know, the big five. But the reality is the industry, you know, significant cornerstone of the industry, you know, from independent booksellers to small and independent publishers, and they're really important. And so, you know, if you lose a lot of small publishers, it means there are that many fewer places publishing books. And I, you know, right. that's really bad for authors. And I mean, I think it's bad for readers.
Rachel Deal, she's at Publishers Weekly. Rachel, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, coming full circle, I suppose, to the big picture economic news of the day, that absolutely staggering unemployment claims number this morning. 6.5 million people this week, added to 3.3 million from last week, 10 million people out of a job basically overnight. Thing is, those jobs, I mean, they bring income, sure, and stability, yes. Also, though, a sense of purpose, and for a lot of people, a sense of self-worth. About 8 or 10 years ago, I did an interview with Philip Levine. Levine was a poet who wrote about and won the Pulitzer Prize for. In fact, his poems about working class Detroit, including this one, which I had asked him to read for us on the air that day. It is called What Work Is.
We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Fort Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is. Although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead a man is waiting who will say, no, we're not hiring today, for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac, so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night, so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him? Held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No. Just because you don't know what work is.
Philip Levine, on this program, if I remember right, just about during the financial crisis. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 469 today, 2.2%. The NASDAQ picked up 126 points, 1.7%. The S&P 500 added 56 points, 2.2% there. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Rick Carr, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.